What measurable human rights abuses are taking place in Ukraine, and how accurately have those abuses been captured by a recent UN report? What kinds of human rights abuses are people of the African diaspora enduring in the midst of the violence in East Ukraine? And with the arrival of the one-year anniversary of the Maidan protests that led to the overthrow of the Yanukovych government and the current civil war in the eastern region, is an all-out war about to break out in Ukraine? What is the strategic significance of the southeast Donbass region to Western ambitions, and is it worth deliberately provoking the Russian bear? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we will hear perspectives from Brigham University Bartle Emeritus Professor of Sociology James Petras and from Vancouver-based writer and anti-war activist Roger Annis. We will also hear from an Ethiopian-Ukrainian businessman on the ground in Donetsk, living in fear in the wake of reported beatings and mistreatment from Kiev forces and so-called independists. On this week's show, Flashpoint East Ukraine, War and the Human Rights Question. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 28th, 2014. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major stories shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. Our show is also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. A coup took place in Kiev. A considerable part of the country supported it, and they were happy, partly because they believed that after the signing of, say, the association agreement, there will be open borders, job opportunities, the right to work in the European Union, including in Germany. They thought that it will be like that. In fact, they have nothing of the sort. The other part of the country, the southeast, did not support it and said, quote, "We do not recognize you." And instead of starting a dialogue, instead of explaining to people that the central authorities in Kiev are not going to do anything bad, and on the contrary, they will propose various forms of coexistence and development of a common state, they are ready to grant them their rights. Instead of that, they began making arrests at night. That was from the translated comments of President Vladimir Putin from a televised interview with German television network ARD, found in the article, Interview with President Vladimir Putin, The Crisis in East Ukraine, The Sanctions Regime, Russian-German Relations, posted November 27th. Breitbart by Kelly Serio, July 23rd, 2014. I was on board the USS Ronald Reagan and went directly through a radiation cloud. Sailors worked tirelessly while being left vulnerable to dangerous levels of radiation. Most of us on board the ship were tested for radiation exposure, and many came back positive, resulting in full-body scrubdowns. Proper medical care for the victims of radiation exposure is needed. It's a dire situation for many. Many of us are enduring the unfortunate consequences and hoping for care from the VA that appears to never arrive. We are reassured of our good health despite the presence of mysterious, unexplained symptoms. A lack of coverage by the mainstream media has left victims without a voice. That was from the article, Two U.S. Sailors Dead After Fukushima Radiation Exposure, posted November 26th, originally appearing at ENE News. The sudden reconciliation between Saudi Arabia and Qatar has enormous implications for the war in Syria and beyond, with the potential to divide the Mideast and North Africa between rulers Abdullah and Thani in a more far-reaching way than Sykes and Picot did nearly 100 years ago. Saudi Arabia and its Bahraini and Emirati clients ended their Cold War with Qatar last Sunday and reinstated their ambassadors to Doha. They had previously been unprecedentedly withdrawn 8 months ago in March to protest Qatar's support for the Muslim Brotherhood, which the kingdom saw as a threat to their rule. A few days before this major announcement, another Mideast rift had been supposedly patched up between the Al-Nusra Front, rumored to be affiliated with Qatar, and ISIL, which has alleged links to wealthy Saudis, to work together in overthrowing the Syrian government, which may have portended Qatar and Saudi Arabia's own reconciling. Now that Doha and Riyadh have reached an agreement to resolve their rivalry, they'll likely divide the Mideast and North Africa amongst themselves to avoid any future conflict of interests, with Qatar getting influence west of Egypt and Saudi Arabia reigning to its east. That was from the article, Reconciliation Between Saudi Arabia and Qatar, Implications for the War in Syria, by Andrew Korybko, posted November 26th, originally appearing at Oriental Review. The demonstrations on the Maidan were supported by Western governments and led to a bloody coup that brought right-wing pro-Western forces to power. Now, 1 year on, five parliamentary parties, all of which supported the Maidan protests, have formed a coalition that plans to intensify a policy of war and enforce vicious cuts in social spending. On Monday, President Petro Poroshenko confirmed these plans and announced a referendum on joining NATO within 6 years. Just a few days earlier, Poroshenko had decided to slash all state funding and pensions to the areas of eastern Ukraine controlled by pro-Russian separatists. As a result, schools, hospitals, and emergency services will no longer be funded, and pensions and benefits will not be paid. That was from the article, New Coalition Plans to Expand War Against Eastern Ukraine, by Christoph Dreyer, posted November 27th, originally appearing at the World Socialist website. Financial writer Bill Holter says the players in the gold markets are fearful. Holter also says that the COMEX market is what he calls cornerable. Holter says, quote, "The way I put it is it's a ham sandwich without the ham or the cheese. You are talking about $1 billion would be enough to clean out COMEX gold registered category, and another $1 billion would clean out the silver inventory," unquote. That was from the article, The Players in the Gold Market Are Fearful, Upholding the Dollar Through Market Manipulation of Gold and Silver Prices, by Greg Hunter and Phil Holter, posted November 27th, originally appearing at USA Watchdog. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Joining us now to discuss further the human rights situation in East Ukraine is Roger Annis. He's a writer and anti-war activist, a resident in Vancouver, British Columbia. He attended the anti-war conference in Yalta this past summer and is also an editor of the new website, The New Cold War, Ukraine and Beyond. Roger Annis, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's good to be with you.
Okay, now, in mid-November, the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights released its latest report on the human rights situation in Ukraine based on the work of the United Nations Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine during the months of September and October. And, the report, in my view, seems to place as much, if not most, of the blame for human rights abuses during the monitoring period on the forces rejecting Kiev authority in Donetsk and Luhansk, while downplaying, if not ignoring, abuses by the Ukrainian government. What aspects of this report, in your mind, would demonstrate that the report is not only flawed, but perhaps a deliberate deception for political purposes?
I think you summed the report up well. This is the seventh monthly report that the UN Office on Human Rights has issued. And, yeah, the bias that you speak of runs throughout the report. This office, like the monitoring mission of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which also has a monitoring mission in Ukraine, neither of them recognize at all the governing authorities in what's now this autonomous political region of Luhansk and Donetsk. And so that bias runs throughout the report. The information delivered to this UN committee by the authorities in southeast Ukraine is always sort of described in the report as, you know, very much subject to doubt. And the information from the Ukrainian government, which the report cites, typically treated as the good solid information. Above all, in the report, you don't really get a sense of who is responsible for the war that's going on in eastern Ukraine. The reports are interesting to read because they do contain factual information that's important to know. For example, this latest report says now that the death toll from the war is now 4,000 people. And the report says this is a conservative estimate, but this is the best estimate which another monitoring officials can come up with. So, I mean, that's extremely important to note. And if you read the report carefully, it will give you show you the description of quite dire living circumstances in the war region of eastern Ukraine, specifically southeast Ukraine. So there's a lot of information like that. If you read the report carefully, it can be useful. And I say read it carefully because it is a lengthy report. It's 50 pages, and it's not every citizen that's trying to follow events in Ukraine is going to be able to read through it. Unfortunately, the news summaries of these monthly reports tend to just talk about a couple of headlines. And so in the case of this specific report, news agencies internationally did report the figure of 4,000 deaths from the war. And that's about it. Now, to take a couple of the most egregious of the human rights violations that have been going on from this war, this report only touches briefly on the report issued by the New York Times and by Human Rights Watch. Both issued their own independent reports on October 20th, detailing the use of cluster weapons by the governing regime in Kiev against the citizens of eastern Ukraine. So that's mentioned in the UN report, but without any suggestion of who may have been responsible. So the report is just full of bias in the way in which it reports the events that are taking place. And specifically, it describes the war being waged by Kiev and eastern Ukraine as basically a legitimate war of self-defense by a national government against armed groups, is the term that they use. Kiev itself uses the term terrorists to describe the people fighting for political autonomy in eastern Ukraine. So, you know, that's why I wrote the article that I did on the report, because while it contains useful information that's important to know, overall it's a very biased production and needs to be approached very cautiously in order to, you know, to get the good information that is in there out and in context.
Yeah, I noticed that. They use the term the so-called authorities in Crimea continuing to conduct raids, actively searching for weapons and religious literature, but you don't hear, you know, sort of a similar modifier with regard to the Kiev government, which many journalists and of course the Russian government have said is, you know, basically a push that was basically a coup. So I don't know if you'd if that's an example of the kind of bias you're talking about.
Oh, exactly. I think that's the other big example in the report, is that the vote by the Crimean people back in March to secede from Ukraine and rejoin Russia, and I use that term rejoin because Crimea was part of what was then the Soviet Union until 1954, when it became an autonomous region of Ukraine, a constitutional slight of hand decision made at the time. This UN office, like the OSCE mission, does not recognize the legitimacy of the vote of the Crimean people back in March. They consider that the government of what's now the a part of the Russian Federation in Crimea is illegitimate. And so this language also pervades the report, and the report goes about, you know, trying to find violations of human rights in Crimea, which they can report. I don't think there's anywhere in the world where you couldn't go and find violations of human rights. So I'm not sure, you know, what the news is here. And certainly compared to what's been going on in Ukraine, the violations of human rights in Crimea would pale in comparison to what's happening north of their border.
Mm. Do you have any comments about there's a lot of mention about the minority and indigenous groups and those in a position of vulnerability, the growing number of enforced disappearances of Crimean Tatars. I was wondering if you have a comment about that and the whole the general reporting on the IDPs, the internally displaced peoples.
Yeah. Well, the situation with internally displaced people is very grave indeed. This report says, I've seen a figure this high, but I'll accept it as good coin. It says that there's been 400,000 people from eastern Ukraine that have been forcibly dislocated by the war. We know from this report mentions this not very much detail at all. We certainly know from other reports that the conditions that these people who have been forcibly displaced elsewhere in Ukraine are very serious indeed. In fact, I was at a conference in Ottawa at the end of October that was held at the University of Ottawa, and the head of the main spokesperson, I should say, for the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, who's a Canadian of Ukrainian origin, gave a talk at a conference in Ottawa. I reported on this in an article, and he said that the situation in eastern Ukraine is on the verge of a humanitarian disaster. I think that's accurate, his description, and that's incidentally, it's not the kind of situation described in the UN report. It doesn't put things in that grave context, but certainly many other reports indicate this. So you don't get that sense in the report. The numbers are there, 400,000, but the fact that people are having difficulty finding accommodation. There are many people living particularly exposed to the elements. They're in sort of canvas tents or difficult to find jobs. Very little social services available to them by way of healthcare. Children finding it difficult to go to school. So this is all sort of, say it's touched on in the report, but certainly not at all gone into it in depth. And the report actually makes only a one sentence reference to the people who have been forcibly displaced to Russia from eastern Ukraine. And according to Russian authorities, not just the government, but the agencies that are looking after these people, more than 1 million people that have been had to flee eastern Ukraine to Russia. They're much better taken care of there because Russia is a warrior country and has more resources. So, you get bits and pieces of facts of this in the report. The report spends 7 pages trying to find a crisis of internally displaced people from Crimea. It doesn't make a convincing case, and I haven't seen any corroborating reports that would, indicate a problem on the scale of what's happened in eastern Ukraine. The report says there's about 20,000 people of Crimean origin that have been displaced and living in Ukraine. Now, this report doesn't say what previous reports have said, which is that people in Crimean Tatars who have been displaced to Ukraine, some of them are beginning to return to Crimea because they simply can't survive and they don't get services. Their children can't go to school and so forth. So, overall, humanitarian situation in Ukraine right now, for a number of reasons, not just the internally displaced people, is very grave indeed.
I just wanted to move on now to another topic relating to the anti-Semitic incidents. We've had statements from Jewish leaders in Ukraine that are basically accusing the Russians or Putin of stoking that as part of their propaganda campaign, I guess. And I mean, it kind of makes it difficult to try to get the facts, because the Western media are completely ignoring the idea that some of these fascist and ultra nationalist paramilitary groups are the authors of a lot of persecution in these areas, and just ignoring that whole background, the Banderites and whatnot. What do you say to that phenomenon of these groups that are apparently, you know, backing the wrong pony, as it were?
Yes, that's come both from people speaking on behalf of Ukraine's Jewish community, and also people that claim to be spokespeople of the Tatar people of Crimea, who are living in Ukraine, not in Crimea. Both groups have made statements really since the war by Kiev began in April. Statements to the effect that national or religious minorities in Ukraine, and specifically Jews and Tatars, really don't have anything to worry about the ascendance of the far right, extreme right groups in Ukraine. We're not seeing, widespread, massive attacks on these communities at this point in time. But for these leaders to be saying that there's really nothing to be worried about the ascendance of extreme right and far right politics in Ukraine is a very dangerous game. I mean, there have certainly been attacks. We've seen monument to the Babi Yar massacre during World War II in Kiev, that monument is in Kiev itself. We've seen that attack and deface several times. People have been assaulted in Ukraine, and the Jewish community in Ukraine has organized self-defense units. So clearly they feel that there's a concern there. I think it's very misguided for them to really to be playing Kiev's game and also NATO's game in downplaying the threat of the rise of the far right in Ukraine. The far right did quite well in these recent elections, October 26th, to the Ukraine parliament. They directly elected representatives, and then the far right representatives were present on the ballot of the larger parties than themselves. And of course, the far right has organized something like a dozen paramilitary battalions that are fighting in eastern Ukraine, but that are also, highly present and visible in Ukraine's towns and cities. So it's a dangerous game to be playing along with NATO and Kiev in this, in downplaying and dismissing of the threat of the far right. I would hope that that course might change, because certainly Ukrainians themselves are looking at this question seriously, are quite concerned with the growing influence of the extreme right in Ukraine, and the tolerance of the extreme right by the Ukraine government and also by its international allies.
Okay, now on last Friday at the United Nations, there was a vote submitted by Russia that to basically fight the glorification of Nazism. And Canada was one of only three nations to actually vote against that resolution. It seems a remarkable thing. In their defense, the foreign affairs spokesperson, Francois Lassalle, had said that, quote, this resolution was a reference to a highly politicized and anti-Semitic outcomes of the 2001 World Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa. And given its narrow focus and these concerns, Canada did not vote in favor of the resolution. What do you make of that vote and that excuse?
Well, I think, those that have been fortunate enough to find out about it, because mainstream media in Canada has basically been suppressing the news, are quite shocked that Canada would vote against this resolution. It was a seven-page resolution, detailing the duty and responsibility of the United Nations member countries to combat racism, and specifically the glorification of of Nazism. The resolution was discussed and voted on at what's called the Third Committee of the UN General Assembly. It is being referred to the General Assembly itself for a later vote. And it was submitted by Russia, but also by actually a list of about 20 countries, including Vietnam, Venezuela, Pakistan, Nigeria. Yeah, it's about 20 countries that submitted the resolution for a vote. Three countries voted against, as you mentioned, the United States, Canada, and Ukraine. And there were 55 countries that abstained, including all the countries of the European Union, Australia, and New Zealand. The resolution passed by 117 votes, so it will go to the General Assembly. But I think the vote on the resolution is an example of how far Canada and the United States in particular, but also the European Union by virtue of its abstention, are prepared to go, how far they're prepared to go to support the war in Eastern Ukraine and to tolerate and cover up the role that the extreme right and neoconservative right is playing in Ukrainian politics today. The election to the Rada on October 26th has, you know, consolidated a neoconservative right-wing government with significant influence and participation from extreme right forces, and you know, Canada and the U.S. are prepared to turn a blind eye to that in their ongoing support of Ukraine's war, and also the ongoing drive to weaken, isolate, and ultimately to try and attack Russia. So I think it's something that anybody in Canada should be deeply concerned about.
Well, I don't know. I don't think there's anything in that resolution about Ukraine per se. So it still seems kind of hard to understand why, I mean, but for the grace of a silent mainstream media, they would put themselves out on a limb like that.
Yeah, that's a good point you make. It's not that the resolution was provocative in some way. That is, had some kind of a message where if you vote for it, you're voting to criticize or comment on anything going on in Ukraine. So, but, you know, from the standpoint of the sponsors of the resolution, Russia and the other countries I mentioned, the other countries, I mean, they're looking at a situation not just in Ukraine, but in France and in many countries in Europe where we're seeing extreme right forces become more and more legitimized. So they certainly have a concern, and that's, you know, one of the sources in this of the resolution itself. So, you know, quite a reasonable proposition to make major countries that are supposed to be leading the world today don't have a lot of concern about the rise of the extreme right and this new glorification of the Nazism that goes along with that.
Yes, well, very, very grim outlook here. But Roger Annis, I want to thank you very much for once again coming on our show and sharing those perspectives with us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's good talking to you.
Okay. So we've been joined by Roger Annis, based in Vancouver, BC. He is one of the editors of the new website, The New Cold War, Ukraine and Beyond. You can visit his articles. You could see some of his articles at newcoldwar.org. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. The situation facing minority populations in eastern Ukraine has not been well addressed by most media. I managed to secure an interview with one Tefera Alemu, an Ethiopian businessman and father living in Ukraine, who is appealing for help from the international community. He spoke to us from an undisclosed location in Donetsk. Now, I'm reading a press release from SOCEP, and they're talking about the Ethiopians and their families are being beaten. and mistreated by these independists?
By the rebels. It's a common thing, yeah. We cannot, there's no law. It's now we're living in a banana republic, you know. No law. Anybody can hit you. Anybody can take your children for organ. You don't have nobody to complain to. Only what you try to do is just trying to hide in the bomb shelling camp underground. It's a real problem. Yeah.
Okay, so... Yeah, so you like this all started. This, I guess, it would have started a few months ago when the civil war broke out.
No, it is when the war broke out. A lot of problems started. Initially, before the war, everything is okay.
Okay.
Even if you're talking about racism, it's not like that in where we are living. But after the war breaking, you know, different kind of group of people came in. You cannot call them in normal people because all the junkies and all the group of bandits and people with uniform, you don't know. You can't even see their face because everybody always wear a mask. You don't know who is even talking with you. Everybody with gun, with aftermath and all kind of knife and some other thing. It's very, very scared.
So
you don't know who can come for you at any time. That's too risky.
Okay, I'm just maybe a few more details about actual incidents where people have been the Kiev forces, are they people being beaten, assaulted?
No, you know, beating people is a common thing now because there's no law regulating, you know, and when you become a foreigner, you are not. It became a more problem. Even the children cannot go to school no more. We are all at the house. Everybody is just hiding underground. No more school, no more eating system, and the weather is coming cold. You know, it's pity when your children are crying, "Daddy, what mess?" You started thinking. Mm-hmm. And nobody wants the children to die in this situation because the bombing every time, you're just hearing the bombing shelling. You know, and it's not a common thing for children to be hearing the sound of shooting guns every minute, every second.
Yeah.
No electricity, which is the most worst situation. Sometimes we can't even charge even a common telephone. We need to go and find someone, maybe through the soldiers. If you have a normal one, that is, okay, give me your phone. I will charge it for you. I will bring it back for you. Yes.
I was kind of under the impression that some of these ultra-nationalists are committing... you know, really serious atrocities against people in your population. Are you a witness to any of that? Are you?
Sure.
Yeah.
Even to me, I can tell you, I lost my telephone because someone just beat me and collected my telephone because he's telling me this place belongs to the white people. It's not belong to people from Africa. You see, but who am I going to complain to? Even when my children are asking me, "Oh, Dad, what happened to you? What's happened to you?" I can't tell them the group of uniformed people or people with armed robbery attacking me. I can't tell them. I just need to just be praying to God at home.
Are there
because
other...
There's no more law enforcement agents. It is just a banana republic. Everybody is going off. Everybody with gun is who have power. Who don't have gun, you are nobody. And no more any international organization is not operating here anymore.
So, do you the government in Kiev? You seem to be appealing for international aid. What has there been any attempts
no,
to try? No.
You know, when you say now, I cannot tell you there's a government in Kiev because the rebel in Kiev, which is pro-Russian group, and to them, they cannot say they are the government. Though they can say they are government in control, but they're concentrating on the war against the Ukrainian military than what happened with individual to anybody, which is the most discussed part of it.
So yeah, that while the pro-Russian faction is defending and the Kiev government is bombing, there's no one there to help the people.
No way.
Yeah.
You know, it's just unfortunately that this situation came into the situation whereby you cannot complain to nobody what happened to you. even presently on the ground, nobody care about if we have a food to eat or we don't have a food to eat. It's not their problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even the way we get ordinary water to drink, it's not their problem. The only luckily we have is that some, like my wife, she's a wife and a Ukrainian, sometimes she finds the situation to get out the water. And, you know, maybe I go for water, something can happen to me. She takes a lot of risk too.
Okay.
And I cannot even tell the children to go out with her.
Mr. Alamu, could you tell me another story about a atrocity or racist incident, maybe somebody that you know or possibly even yourself that would help people understand, just how serious the situation is?
Even there's a lot of situation that involves some students, even their kidnapping. Even the problem is that we don't know, maybe they are, but most of them are from African country. They're kidnapped to be working underground, to washing plate for the rebel soldiers and other things like that. But like now, I don't even force myself to go out because it is very, very risky to go outside here. Communication is too poor, you understand? Mm-hmm. You cannot even use the telephone to confirm it from somewhere. Hey, are you okay? Are you alive? Just maybe you try to contact some people maybe once in a blue moon.
Has anybody you know been murdered or raped?
Concerning raping, I don't know anything about that.
Okay.
But concerning death, yeah, there are many from Syria alone, from different African countries. What should we do?
Do you know? So it's not just Ethiopians; it's Africans.
When we say generally, yeah. But presently, I don't even know numbers of Ethiopia. Maybe they are alive, or because we cannot get in touch with some people, we don't know they are alive or not alive. That's the biggest problem. Because there's no way to communicate. It's not like it before. You can go to your friend's house or your countryman's house and you know he's at home. Now you call him. No. We don't have telephone now. We don't have a house phone. Everybody, if you have your mobile phone working, you are very lucky. Many people who have a mobile phone that is not working. That's why I cannot even say exactly how many people are alive presently and who is not alive presently. It's very difficult database.
Okay, Mr. Alamu, what about, we're based in Canada. Is there any, Russia is a lot closer, and it seems as if there might be some sympathy there in terms of people affected by the violence from Kiev. Have you thought of, is there a possibility of potentially escaping to Russia or appealing for help from Russia?
Russia is another country entirely. I cannot be there. And if people came in from Russia, they don't care about foreigners. They care about their own people. I mean, about the Russian people living in this area. That's the only what people they care of. But some, you know, I've been living here for a long time. Some white friends, like the Russians, they do have some time. For example, for giving some food sometimes. You know, my house is glass already. I have a house, I have a country house, it's no more. I have my new house now, I can say it's the grand. it's worth crying, but what shall I do? It's a war.
You've lost everything.
Yeah, and I cannot say anything.
Mm-hmm.
I had a car that the rebels carry, and after some few days, I was telling them my car was already blasted away. What shall I do? I'm not the one that drives the car. Who am I going to complain to? Everybody told you, everybody lost a house, everybody lost you. You understand?
So, you mean people are losing houses to the bombing, or is anybody...
Sure.
Yeah.
almost everybody losing the houses. That's why some of us undergrounding, living under the basement, we are lucky. We don't even know what is happening to some people up there. That's why even to get people, where are you going to find them? No way. You cannot move freely in the city. If not, the war continue.
Okay. Is there any other incidents of threats from the population, the nationalists that maybe you think you could mention that would help us understand a little bit more?
And if you want to talk about something like that, someone need to have more sources information, because most of the people wearing uniform, I told you, they always cover up their faces. You don't know who is who. No, you know it's a white guy, but you cannot differentiate between the Russian and Ukraine when you are under a uniform, you understand? That's because of that, it's difficult information to know. But only while everybody are a war people, and they are continuing with the worship assignment they're having in these places.
So what do you want? What do you want the international community to do?
I want you guys to do for me, not only for me, but I can say even some for other people in this situation. You understand? Because it's just to help us get the children out of this situation. If the children can go out or with our family, we can find a solution. Maybe through the Ukraine government or maybe through Russian government. But if even international body have opportunity to talk with the rebel leaders, if they can find a way just to let us leave the country and get the resettlement somewhere peaceful, it should be better, because there's a blockade everywhere. You cannot just go moving away from the city again. You need to go through some thoroughly checking, and they say, oh, maybe you are getting information or you are informant for maybe the Ukraine government. You know what that means? You mean they can put you somewhere and you lose your job, you lose your life. That's why someone just needs to live a low profile now. And every day things is getting worse and the weather is changing. That's why the best thing, if we can get a resettlement, to be the best solution.
That was Ethiopian businessman Tefera Alimu speaking from an undisclosed location in Donetsk in eastern Ukraine. That interview was recorded November 4th of this year. For more background on the violence confronting Ukrainians from the Ethiopian diaspora and details on how to assist, please visit www.socepp.info and click the link to Ethiopians in Eastern Ukraine Need Urgent Help. Joining us now is James Petrus. He is Bartle Emeritus Professor of Sociology at Binghamton University. Professor Petrus is also a frequent contributor to the Global Research website. His latest book is The Politics of Imperialism, the U.S., Israel, and the Middle East. And he's also the author of a recent article entitled All Out War in Ukraine, NATO's Final Offensive. And that is going to be the subject of our discussion. So thank you for joining us, Professor Petrus.
Thanks for the invitation, Michael. It's always a pleasure to communicate with the folks in Manitoba.
Okay. Now, I notice in your article you do put a special emphasis on the South, not just Ukraine, but the Southeast Donbass region as a major flashpoint, if you will, for the breakout of an upcoming war involving NATO. Is it possible you could just sort of help break it down for us? What is the special interest in that region in particular?
Well, I think the coup that took place in February that overthrew the elected government, Yevtushenko, I think was an effort to turn the Ukraine into a military platform for NATO, more particularly the United States. It also had implications for the European Union as a market basket for its exports and also a source of raw materials, particularly for Germany. The problem is that this regime was highly unpopular. The coup was highly unpopular in Donetsk and Luhansk in the Donbas Basin, and the attempts by the government to convince them failed, and the implementation of policies which, in effect, disbarred the Russian-speaking a bilingual Ukraines in that area, plus the violence in the process of political change, provoked a uprising in the East, a peaceful uprising, which sought to affirm the democratic traditions and to neutralize the coup that took place. And out of that political uprising grew forms of self-defense as the Kiev government, recognizing that it couldn't conquer the southeast through persuasion or coercion, sent the troops in, and the unleashed the neo-fascists were really, neo isn't really the word, were clearly pro-Nazi groups in into combat. And this culminated actually in the burning alive of scores of dissidents in Odessa. Now, this violent activity really was the trigger for the Donbas forces to arm themselves and to secure support from the region, including from Russia. As a consequence of that, the Kiev regime intensified its military offensive, but was unable to conquer. In fact, they suffered a whole series of a string of defeats by the Donbas resistance, who were fighting for their homes and their freedoms and their autonomy. And that culminated in a negotiated temporary ceasefire called the Minsk Agreement, which included the European Union, the junta in Kiev, plus the representatives of the Donetsk area. Now, this ceasefire never took hold. The Kiev forces continued to shell the Democrats, the Federalists in the southeast throughout this, and several hundred people, close to 900 people, have been killed since then. So the ceasefire really hasn't been holding. But in the meantime, the U.S. and the European Union have really escalated their economic sanctions. They've built up, U.S. has sent forces into the Baltic countries, Lithuania and Estonia, Latvia. The Poles have become very active in building up military forces on the border with Russia. So we have a military mobilization, economic sanctions with Russia, all designed to isolate the southeast from any kind of political, diplomatic, and economic support from Russia. The purpose of these sanctions is, one, to isolate the southeast and to facilitate the takeover of power by the Kiev junta and the conquest, with the idea of really ethnic cleansing. There's already been 300,000 refugees have fled the southeast because the Kiev junta has been bombing civilian targets, apartments and markets and schools and hospitals. So it's all out war up to a point. But the problem is Kiev didn't have the military capacity. And so the NATO countries have been sending professional special forces, trainers, and logistical support and lethal, non-lethal aid under the wraps, and I think it's all clear that this military buildup and the efforts to starve out the southeast, weaken the area, force more refugees out, and then to launch an all-out war. And at that point, Russia will have to decide whether it's going to come to the aid of the southeast or surrender a country on its border. as a NATO platform. And I think the U.S. Especially is keen on encircling Russia and overthrowing the Putin regime and bringing back a kind of satellite government they had in the 90s under Yeltsin.
They must know that Russia would not want to stand idly by and allow this takeover of the Donbass region to succeed. Are they mindful? I mean, is part of their aim to deliberately provoke?
Well, I think they're playing the game of saying, well, if the Russians come to the aid of the Donbass, we'll launch an offensive. And if Russia doesn't come to the aid, fine, we'll incorporate the Donbass into our satellite in Kiev. If the Russians do come and they stop the offensive, we can then use that as a pretext to virtually break relations with Russia. So they're playing what they think is a win-win situation. They either turn Kiev, Ukraine, into a military platform, or they use it as a pretext to heighten sanctions and go for a regime change in Russia.
In terms of how things are unfolding right now, I mean, this is the 1 year.
They're totally irresponsible in the sense that they've opened the door to a confrontation, military confrontation. Let's suppose they launch the full-scale offensive that I'm predicting on the southeast. Russia comes to the aid. Now, what does Washington do? The pressures in the U.S. are increasingly bellicose that the U.S. should get more directly involved in the Ukraine, and that would put on the possibility of a nuclear confrontation.
Well, what other cards does Russia have at their disposal?
Well, Russia's got a lot of cards. It's a country with vast resources. It's making a turn to Asia, increasing its $400 billion agreement with China. It could substitute industrial products that they're importing from Germany. They could become a more diversified economy. They're looking to alternative sources of food in Latin America, which would more than supplement whatever local production, what they boycott from Europe. There seems to be some dissension in Europe about how far to go with these sanctions. And in particular, countries like Turkey and India are very ambiguous about the sanctions. They see business opportunities replacing the West. At the same time, they're run by reactionary governments who have one foot in the camp of the West and one foot in the market of Russia. So Russia has internal resources. The big problem with Russia is that some of the top enterprises in Russia are run by oligarchs who have a great many ties to the West. Russia has to clean up its act internally to make sure that the national interest trumps the linkages between the oligarchs and the West.
Now, you also mentioned in your article that the recent G20 meeting in Australia, where Putin was basically treated like a pariah. What do you make of that posturing?
Well, it's a lot of publicity seeking. It's one-upsmanship. Abbott and Harper, the two clowns that were performing there. I think a lot of it was posturing and trying to score merit points with the Obama regime. But the end result was simply to discredit the politicians involved. I think Harper made a joke of himself, and I think it's been pretty much recognized in Canada that kind of personally insulting behavior has no place in great countries. It's much akin to banana republic politics.
Now, presumably, all of these leaders, these G20 leaders, these NATO leaders, they know what a cynical game that they're playing. Is there a face-saving way for them to, you know, back away from the nuclear cliff, having been pronounced themselves
well,
that they
have?
Well,
I don't think they have to save face. I just think they have to resort to negotiations and understanding that they cannot encroach on Russia's frontiers and point missiles at the heartland of Russia from hostile territory. Most people wouldn't frown upon a retraction of the politics. I don't think it would take much to do a turnaround, especially from the point of view of public opinion.
Well,
the only source of difficulty would be the mass media, particularly the right-wing militarist vehicles that would probably call up any attempt to shift gears here.
Well, Professor Petras, maybe to challenge you just a little bit, because it seems to me that there's been so much mass media expression of the idea that it's Putin that's behind all of this. He's a bully. He's going in there. He took over Crimea, and they won't admit that NATO or these National Endowment for Democracy and these other groups have been funding these on the ground militias and neo Nazis and so on. They're never going to admit that publicly. So how do you get around that?
They won't have to admit it. They just change the line. Media have a way of from one day to the other they can switch lines, and for a passive public, it doesn't. The memory of what was and what is can be very short, and I don't think it would. Once a decision is made at the top, just switching sides, switching rhetoric, wouldn't be too hard, since they have totally centralized control. There's a very limited alternative media. I just think that the political commitments are what are crucial here, not the potential for doing for presenting an alternative view. It's the political will. I think the financial press, for example, is very militaristic, even though many of the investors are eager to get back into the Russian market. They're eager to open up trade relations with Iran. I think the press, and in particular the financial press, has become much more militaristic than many of its readers. And I think that the militarist climate in the media has, to some degree, hooked into the most bellicose sectors of the ruling class in the United States and in Europe, and is out of touch with the majority of their own readers.
Mm. Well, I think that maybe that's reflected in the diminishing number of people consuming those media. Professor Petras, I think I have to leave it there. But
okay, Michael, and thank you for the invitation.
Well, thank you for joining me.
Bye.
Bye. We've been speaking with James Petras, Bartle Emeritus Professor of Sociology at Binghamton University. He is also a frequent contributor to Global Research website. His recent article, All Out War in Ukraine, NATO's Final Offensive, is up now on the Global Research website. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.